Hello and welcome to the Beyond Biotech podcast number 51. I'm Jim Cornell from The Biotech, and it was 7 years ago today that the UK voted to leave the EU. No comment on that, but it does show how time passes so quickly, and it's now summer here in the Northern Hemisphere, which it feels like it has been for at least a month already. And just one more week of school here before the 7-week YouTube marathon starts. I can't wait. I think if the weather continues the way it is and the lakes here continue to lose volume, we will find out in about 6 weeks whether there really is a Loch Ness Monster. Before we get to the news you may have missed, I should tell you who we have on the podcast this week. And we have two subjects. One is biomarkers, and that's a great conversation with Mo Jane, CEO of Sapient. And the second subject is an overview of the Lund Spring Symposium, with three people who attended the event, Sander von Deventer, Toas Fioretos, and Dan Larhamar. And so now we'll take a look at some of this week's news headlines from labiotech.eu. We had an article on the use of gene therapy as a promising solution for sickle cell disease. A clinical trial showed the efficacy of a colorectal cancer drug, and clearance was given for an anti-tumor bispecific antibody trial. Anort raised funds to tackle cystic fibrosis, the FDA put a hold on the Arcelex myeloma program, and Fluoguide announced excellent positive results from its head and neck cancer trial. Actually, there's been quite a lot of clinical trial news this week because NodThera announced positive inflammatory disease data. The FDA cleared a T-cell receptor natural killer therapy for sarcoma, and we had an article on the highlights of the Bio International Convention 2023. We had an article on five current advances in osteoporosis research. Nanobody company Atovia Therapeutics launched with $60 million, and the FDA approved a type 2 diabetes drug for children 10 and older. We had an article on biotech company layoffs. An ovarian cancer study found key genes that may lead to potential treatments. And Sandbox AQ announced the launch of a biopharma molecular simulation division. The European Coalition for Access to Comprehensive Genomic Profiling was created. Researchers in China say they have a breakthrough treatment for skin infections, and new disease characteristics were seen as NMD Pharma reported its Charcot-Marie-Tooth results. And you can read all of these and many more at labiotech.eu. Now it's to the interviews, and first this week we're going to have three short conversations about the Lund Spring Symposium, which took place in Sweden at the end of last month. It was two half days and a full day of presentations from companies such as Pfizer and institutions including MIT, Yale, Stanford, ETH Zurich, and many more. And there were three Nobel laureates in attendance, so definitely a high caliber event. So our conversations with the three people who were there. Basically, we covered their own involvement and their impressions of the symposium, and we will kick things off with Toas Fioretos.
So I'm a professor of clinical genetics, so I study mostly leukemias, and I'm very interested in finding out what happens on the leukemia stem cells when they get transformed, and we are looking specifically on markers that pop up on the leukemia stem cells. When we find such markers, we produce antibodies against these, and then we have disease models where we can show a specific targeting against the leukemia stem cell population. And then we are also, of course, looking, because my theory has always been that if you're a cancer cell in the bone marrow or in the blood, you need to use very clever systems to evade the immune system. In contrast to if you are a colon cancer, then you maybe don't use the similar prime mechanisms to escape the immune system. So that's what I'm doing. And I've started two companies in that area, one which is in clinical trials and one just recently where I talked a bit about the new target at this meeting and got a lot of feedback from people that both from the industry and also from academia that attended the meeting.
Right, and what are you discovering?
We have discovered a new, it's unpublished data, but I presented it at the meeting. So we've discovered a specific marker, leukemia stem cells, that for some reason should not be on leukemia stem cells because normally it's expressed on T cells. So this is a mechanism we have proven scientifically that it's really a PD-L1, PD-1-like mechanism, immune checkpoint, that if we knock this receptor out on the leukemia stem cells, then suddenly the T cell starts to kill it. So now what I showed a bit, and that's in progress, is that we now have antibodies trying to interfere or break this immune inhibition from the leukemia stem cell side, and then we can see that the T cell starts killing leukemia. So that's my take. I mean, it's on the scientific side, but now I started a new company and we are taking that further.
What stage are you at with that?
Early stage, yeah. So we were very early stage now, and yeah, we are now taking in the first pre-seed round of money. So that's what we do. So
Okay.
that's very interesting. And we have also other targets. I did not talk so much about that, but that's very nice. And the other company that started 10 years ago is now in phase two randomized trials soon. So that has progressed. That's another marker. But also identified on leukemia stem cells and now in clinical trials in pancreatic cancer and in lung cancer with results that were presented at recent ASCO meeting in lung cancer and also in pancreatic cancer. So yeah, I'm an MD from my background. I want to make a difference for the patients in the end. So, and this is the way to go. You need to start a company to get funding in and produce antibodies.
Is this something that works as a monotherapy, or is it something that works in conjunction
Yes.
with the
So in solid tumor, it's a combination. That's an antibody against the IL-1 co-receptor, which is called IL-1RAP. And there's quite convincing evidence that if you combine it with cytostatics, you get an additive effect. So that's not a monotherapy, but in leukemias, I could very well envision monotherapy.
You mentioned that the reception, lots of questions and lots of interest at the conference. What kind of discussions?
Yeah, I mean, and that I think was the beauty by the conference. So highly competent people, both from pharma, right, and three Nobel Prize winners. It's seldomly that you get people at leading positions as big pharma, like the research, the global head of research, Mikael Dolsten, to participate together with Nobel Prize winners and to be able to present your results in such a setting with only 200 or 250 attendees. So I think that was good, and a lot of questions working on similar problems in cancer, antibodies, and so on. So that was I got a lot of feedback and good contacts, definitely. And then the conference also provided a very broad perspective view on molecular pharmacology, kind of cross entities and cross different compounds, etc. So it was really lovely being a geneticist, cancer researcher, and then having this overview of different chemicals or biologicals and combinations thereof. It was one of the best conferences I've attended the last years, and I haven't been at many.
So overall, you thought it was a good event?
It was a super great event, really. High quality science, high quality pharma development in early phases, and I mean, among different types of disorders. It was not only cancer, it was immune disorders and also different types of treatments, and then basic pharmacology.
Do you think that something positive will come out of some of the discussions?
Oh, yes. I'm convinced I already have contacts with a few people following this conference. So, definitely, yes.
You would be in favor of this happening again?
Definitely. That was my first mail after the meeting. I wrote to Mikael Dolsten and Klaas and Lars Grundemar, who was the main organizer, and said that this you have to do again.
Anything that you would change about it, or how would you see it evolving?
Probably. I mean, it was, I think the mix here, you know, with high level speakers from both pharma and academia, mixed with some more local speakers, certainly provided a fertile ground from different types of discussions. So, I mean, my only awareness would be that this probably, if it extends and gets too big, then again, it becomes more of these traditional meetings that you attend. So, I think the smaller format is certainly makes it more worthwhile visiting and interacting.
Now we head to the Netherlands and get the thoughts of Sander van Deventer. So first, I wonder if we could get a bit of background on what you do.
Yeah, sure. So actually, I'm trained as a doctor. I was a gastroenterologist and a professor of medicine and all that. But I have a long history of drug development, starting with monoclonal antibodies already in the late 80s. And I was one of the guys actually that drove the development of Remicade in the early 90s. That became a big antibody, of course. And then later was involved like projects with natalizumab and Stelara and other antibodies that are now mainly blockbusters. But later in the 80s, in the 90s, I also started to work on antisense molecules. I did one of the first antisense trials with Isis, which is now Ionis. And in 1998, I started a gene therapy company that became Unicure later. So that is now listed. And actually, I developed two of the five approved AAV-based gene therapy products, starting with Glybera, which was the first actually to get approval and Hemgenix was the latest approval, so just recently. So in the meantime, I also was one of the founders of Forbion, which is one of the larger life science venture capital companies. So I was the managing partner for a couple of funds there. Then I became an operating partner, so basically involved in starting up companies. And so I did a couple of those. One of which is now NewAmsterdam Pharma, which is a NASDAQ-listed company, and some of which were sold. And since 2.5 years now, I'm back with my feet in the mud in a gene therapy company called Vectory, with a Y at the end. And so we're doing, basically, we're targeting proteinopathies in the brain, so in the CNS space. So we start with an ALS program and we have a Huntington program, but the technology that we develop basically is for really for the larger neurodegenerative diseases as well. So that's where we are.
As far as the Lund Spring Symposium, what was your involvement in that?
Actually, I know Lars, of course, over the years I've had multiple interactions, and I know Lund University because there were some spin outs that I had been looking at and interacted with. And so then Lars actually invited me to come over. And then I said, well, I'm really busy, Lars. But then I looked at the program and I thought, wow, this is a really big, great thing. And so what attracts me actually is the thing that Lars and I really have in common. You know, we're both doctors and we are both involved in developing quite novel technologies. We've both been in the lab and we've both, did biotech development. And so you don't see many of those anymore. So we severely regret that. So I think the big thing that Lars did here is basically set up a symposium where the, if you wish, the worlds meet. You know, big time, I must say, because, of course, you know, if you look at the speakers and the quality of the presentations and what was discussed, it was really, really, really a great symposium.
What were the highlights for you?
Two things, actually. Basically, some big shots, Bob Langer and what have you, and Samolsky, and of course, talking about how things have evolved, you know, with the technologies when it comes to non-viral or viral delivery systems, developing therapies and all that. I think that was very insightful. And then it was intermingled with younger people discussing, you know, the state of the art, cutting edge, novel stuff. All of it actually had a translational aspect. Huh? So almost all of it went from bench to bedside. So I think, you know, that is great, because nowadays, if you go to congresses and conferences and meetings, there are very few that are translational. You go to a very specialized this or a very specialized that. I also actually sent a mail to Lars how much I thought this was a great initiative in that respect.
So looking forward to the next one in 2025.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is where we need to go. And I was also hinting a little bit, you know, I'm a little bit also involved in policies and what have you. But I think this actually should be on the agenda of the EU, and probably also of the different countries, because now we are just basically training doctors that know nothing about, you know, where it all comes from and what cutting edge technologies actually are. They just follow guidelines or what can or cannot be done. It's very restricted, so we lack people who are doctors and develop stuff. And I think doctors actually are really important in developing the novel things when it comes to gene or cell therapy or whatever new technologies emerge, because they sense much better than scientists what can work and what can, you know, what certainly cannot work. So I think the interaction is absolutely crucial. And if we don't remedy the lack of interaction that there is now, then we'll get more, you know, very expensive therapies that basically have marginal effects or no effect. And so I think for policymakers and for people who fund research, this also is very recommendable.
So you think that's a direction that obviously the symposium content maybe shouldn't change, but you think that that's something that would be beneficial, is to bridge some of those gaps?
Yeah, I think it would be fantastic if some policymakers basically are informed, you know, what sort of things are being done by Lars there, and how well it is received, you know, and how much it fills an enormous gap, a gap that is widening and that we need to remedy. So I think that is the main other thing that that we could actually ask Lars to focus a little bit on. It's really unique in this respect, this focus here. And so I would really cherish this and see if we can get more of these.
And last but not least, let's head back to Sweden to hear the thoughts of Dan Larhammar.
Before we talk about the event itself, I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about what you do and some of the things that you work on.
Yeah, so my name is Dan Larhammar. I'm a professor of molecular cell biology here in the medical faculty of Uppsala University. I usually describe myself as a neuroscientist, and I study various components in the brain at the molecular level. I've been working mostly with neuropeptides and neuropeptide receptors, but also some hormones, some classical neurotransmitters like dopamine and noradrenaline and serotonin. We have a pharmacological touch to what we do, because the ultimate aim is, of course, to hope that this will lead to something useful, although I do not work with drug development myself, but I teach pharmacology.
Talking about the event that just happened, I wonder if you could give me your impressions of the event.
It was a quite impressive event, thanks to the wonderful quality of the speakers. There was a series of really excellent presentations that covered several different fields, especially immune therapy. There were presentations on cancer, COVID-19, of course, but also in neuroscience, cardiovascular, metabolism. So there was a little bit of everything. And there were some really prominent speakers that gave overviews as well as cutting-edge research front data.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned previously, you'd mentioned the fact that the Nobel laureates were there, which is quite, I don't say it's unusual, but it's good to have so many and have them so prominent.
Yeah. So there were three award lectures named after previous Nobel laureates. And one of them was, in fact, there, Bengt Samuelsson, who is a professor emeritus at the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm. He received the Nobel Prize way back in, 1982, it must have been, for his discoveries on the prostaglandin system. And the two recent laureates who were invited to give lectures were David Julius, who received the Nobel Prize only 18 months ago for his discovery of the temperature receptor, most commonly known, I think, as the capsaicin receptor. And the other one was Brian Kubilka for his work on G-protein coupled receptors. And this was a special treat for me, because I've been working on G-protein coupled receptors for a couple of decades, and my lab is now working on the evolution of the temperature ion channels that David Julius have characterized. So I was delighted to listen to their updates of their results.
Were you able to chat with him afterwards?
No, David Julius was very busy because he was in Lund to become an honorary doctor at that university. So he only attended the conference to give his lecture. And I only had the chance to ask one question to Brian Kobilka, but I've been to other conferences where he has participated.
Is it something that you think needs to happen again?
Yes, I was delighted to hear that the organizers plan to have this as a biannual event. It was a full house of participants, so this surely was very timely. Now, of course, there is a need to get together and discuss with one another again after the pandemic we have endured. But hopefully this enthusiasm to meet again will persist for another few years so that this can become a tradition. I surely hope so.
With hindsight, is there anything that you think would enhance the conference? Or is it perfect the way it is?
It was very well organized, sufficiently long presentations, so one could hear a complete story for the big stars that gave presentations, mixed with the shorter presentations from local researchers and some smaller companies. And there were fairly generous coffee breaks, so one could meet at the posters or catch other participants to discuss different matters. I think this format was ideal for that purpose.
And some very interesting posters as well, quite varied.
Yes, there was quite a range.
So looking forward to the next one, I guess.
I really am.
It will be in Lund again, I would assume.
Yes, this is a Lund event, that's for sure.
I know sometimes they like to rotate them around different places, but it makes sense to have it in the same place.
Mm. Yeah. Lund has initiated an effort to expand pharmacology after several years of decline. So I think this is a good way to raise interest. And Lund has also many smaller pharma companies. So there is a good market for this kind of events there, both in academia and in pharmaceutical industry.
With it being the first one, reputations spread, so probably there'll be more interest from people globally to attend the next time.
The organizers aimed high and were extremely successful. So I think they have put themselves on the map. So if they can follow up with another conference like this in 2 years, it will become a tradition. I do hope so.
The fact that you mentioned that it was packed, I think that if you aim high and have a stadium, then clearly it's not going to be full. But it's nice to have an arena that you can fill and that feels intimate, yet still you have enough people to make it viable.
Exactly. It is important to have sort of the equivalent size of the venue in relation to the interest and demand from participants. One particularly interesting thing that struck me was that I think it was at least three presentations from successful researchers who described how problematic the initial stages of their careers had been. They described all the hardships they had been through, a lot of doubt from colleagues and funders, but through perseverance and dedication, they managed to bring their ideas to something successful and useful. Now, of course, in hindsight, it's the winners' stories we hear, but it was nevertheless very interesting to hear how difficult it had been. And I'm sure this must be very inspiring from young scientists to know that by persistence, one can really accomplish something. And what counts is to get the data. Reliable data. That's the core of science and research.
It's an important point that you mentioned that, because I think that quite often, not just conferences, but we hear about successes and we hear about the sort of the end of the road and we don't hear about the beginnings. And also people entering into any field need encouragement and they need to understand that the path isn't always easy.
And especially for COVID-19, now with the extremely successful mRNA vaccines, It is important to realize that much of that research was done decades ago. The nanovesicles that are used to deliver the mRNA, that work was initiated in the 1980s and was carried out much in the 1990s. Then the mRNA molecules themselves with the modified nucleotides, that was done 20 years ago or more. And people were screening for modified nucleotides that would make the mRNA more resistant to degradation. And out of, I think it was 12 different nucleotides that were tested, only one served this purpose. So it's a long and winding road to find the ideal solutions to these pharmacological challenges.
Is there anything else that you wanted to talk about the meeting?
Yeah, it was interesting to hear about some ideas and principles that I would never have thought were feasible 30 years ago when I, or 40 years ago when I was a PhD student. For instance, having molecules that target, small molecules that target RNAs to block the use of mRNAs and so forth. Since RNA consists of only four different types of molecules, I would have thought that it would be very difficult to tailor make drugs that would target that. But it turns out that this seems to be possible now, thanks to the specific secondary structures of the RNA molecules. The way they fold, they become unique, and thereby one can design drugs that target RNAs with a special folding. So that's an interesting concept. I hope that will work out, because that will open new possibilities, of course.
And I know things don't always necessarily move extremely quickly, but maybe that will be something to update at the next one.
Yeah, I'm sure there will be a new data along that path. So I'm looking forward to that.
And let's just hope that there's no new medical crisis that has to be addressed before then.
Yes, but I think we are much better prepared now than we were for SARS-CoV-2. Now that we have the mRNA tool to adjust and modify, and that can be done so quickly. You know, that's one of the great advantages with mRNA vaccines.
All right, if your calendar goes far enough ahead, definitely pencil the second edition of the Lund Spring Symposium into your calendars for 2025. Now we're talking about biomarkers and precision medicine and quite a few other things in an interesting and wide-ranging conversation with Mo Jane, CEO of Sapient.
So I guess if we could start with a bit of background on the company and what you're doing in the biomarker discovery space.
Sure, happy to, Jim, and I appreciate your time this morning. Thank you very much for the invitation. We're kind of excited to be here today and chat a little bit about what Sapient does. And so the very basis and our concept behind our organization is a simple one, and that is, you know, drug development is an incredibly expensive and complicated process that's fraught with failure. And unfortunately, despite all the great technological advances over the last several decades, that hasn't changed for the most part. And the statistics are staggering. It costs over $1 billion in over a decade to bring a drug to market. And even once that actually occurs, when you look at the response rates for therapeutics across all areas of disease, and even in the targeted oncology space, there's only a fraction of individuals that respond to any given therapy. And so this is the basic problem that we were established to hopefully contribute to the solution. And how do we go about building drugs and developing drugs at a faster pace in a much more efficient manner and deploying drugs across the population in a much more targeted, personalized fashion? And the real idea behind this is one around biomarkers. And biomarkers have the power to be able to identify individuals at a very early stage of disease processes and to really begin to orient the right individual with their specific disease process and ultimately the right therapeutic. And so this was the very basis, as I mentioned, behind Sapient, and how do we go about discovering biomarkers at a much, much faster rate than was previously done in the past. And we've seen sort of the transformation in the oncology space owing to genomic biomarkers. And again, how do we take that idea now and extend it way beyond oncology to many other therapeutic areas?
Can we also go back a little bit to the formation of the company, because I think that's probably quite interesting too, in terms of the process of spinning out a company and how that process was for you?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm going to give you the slightly longer answer for this, just so you get the sense as to where we came. But the background is interesting in that I had done all my clinical training and scientific training in Boston. And this was really at the dawn of the genomic revolution, when next-gen sequencing was just being really commercialized, and we could finally sequence genomes at scale across large populations. And as I was finishing my clinical training, I went on to do my scientific work in this space. And one of the real sort of questions I kept on asking myself is if we were able to really scale this and line every single person up on the planet and sequence every single genome, how much of disease risk could we really explain? And the numbers are staggering in that it's probably on the order of 15 to 20%, which means 80% of disease risk has nothing to do with who your parents are and your conception, but rather is laying in sort of the way in which you live your life, everything you eat, drink, smell, smoke, the world in which you live, how the microbes that you're exposed to operate, your diet, how your internal organ systems communicate. And I was very interested in being able to capture that information, that 80% that was missed by the genome. And this is the missing component of disease risk. And as I began sort of engaging in this space much more, it became clear that that information, again, is not encoded in genomic sequence, but rather in small molecule chemistry. And so I spent years as an academic, the last decade initially in Boston, then ultimately in the University of California system, developing technologies that allow us to really interrogate these circulating small molecule chemistries at scale across large populations, essentially measuring thousands of things in human blood across tens of thousands of people at a time in order to identify biomarkers of disease risk. Now, all of this is embedded in a technology called mass spectrometry that has had a number of technical advances over the last decade or so, particularly with the introduction of what we call high-resolution desktop instruments. These instruments got smaller and they got more powerful. The challenge is that they had not gotten much faster. And so we developed ways to take mass spectrometers and make them go substantially faster in a way that, again, allows us to measure thousands of things across tens of thousands of people at a time. And ultimately, what happened is we were developing these technologies on the academic side. A number of organizations were quite interested in working with us, whether it be biopharma organizations, early biotech, foundations and nonprofits, governmental organizations, who essentially were coming to us and saying, we have these large sample sets, these 10,000 people from this clinical trial or from this study. Can you help us analyze these? And that's really what gave birth to Sapient. It was a desire to democratize access to these technologies in a way that would allow for enabling of drug development to target identification. And so we ultimately spun out Sapient approximately two and a half years ago. And since then, it's been a sort of a roller coaster upwards.
And as far as some of the challenges, what would you say some of the major challenges there are in the space and how will you keep that trajectory upwards, I guess?
Yeah, so the challenges really sort of can be bucketed in two areas. The first is technical. And so developing technologies, essentially, you're always kicking the bottleneck down the road. Once you improve the hardware, then it becomes a software issue. Once you improve the software, it becomes a databasing and information sort of systems issue. And so there's always an emerging technology sort of bottleneck, if you will, as you generate data and develop tech. And those are, for the most part, quite solvable. There's enough sort of infrastructure available. We've learned enough from the genomics revolution. We can continue to sort of improve and improvise both from a hardware as well as a software development perspective. The second real bucket is around education. And as innovative as the biopharma world is, the idea of using new technologies to measure new things as a means for driving drug development is still an emerging idea. And so being able to educate and work together with pharma organizations in a collaborative manner to utilize these technologies and utilize the data that emerges from them is a process that takes time and it takes conversation. And so that's what we spend a good portion of our day doing.
What kind of conditions is this relevant to that you're working in?
Yeah, so the basic idea, Jim, is the technologies allow us to take any biological specimen, whether it be blood, meaning plasma, serum, urine, CSF, a tumor sample, cells in a dish, even rare fluids, tears, eye fluids, et cetera, et cetera. And those biological samples, we can assay somewhere in the order of about 15,000 small molecule biomarkers, and we can do it very, very quickly in a way that allows us to handle thousands of samples per day. Now, as you can imagine, these tools can be applied in many, many different ways and across many different therapeutic areas. You can imagine being able to develop early diagnostics for cancer, heart disease, lung disease, neurodegenerative diseases, GI and liver illness, et cetera, is one major area. Understanding, again, disease processes, coming up with markers that tell us how people are going to progress in their disease, whether or not they're going to have a slow, indolent sort of disease progression, or they're going to be a rapid progressor. Being able to subset very complex diseases such as diabetes that are systemic and involve multiple organ systems and really represent half a dozen diseases that have been put together, and being able to subset those according to molecular pathology in a way that allows us to target therapies better is another major application. Companion diagnostics, new target identification and validation, et cetera, et cetera. So my simple point is that these technologies can be applied for many, many different questions across virtually every single therapeutic area. Now, traditionally, biomarkers in this space in the oncology world have really focused on genomic markers. But as you can imagine, as we've gone from more targeted therapies to more immune-based therapies, again, there's now a role for non-genomic markers in helping to identify the ideal patient who's going to respond to an immunotherapy modulator.
Earlier, you mentioned genomics, and it's really been the focus of biomarker discovery, I guess, over the last decade. What do you think have been the limiting factors in looking beyond the genome, and why do you think now is the time for metabolomics?
Yeah, it's a great question, Jim. And so genomics certainly has been transformative. We've been able to learn quite a bit about the genomic basis for disease using next-generation sequencing. And particularly in the oncology space now, we've been able to leverage these biomarkers to really understand the molecular pathogenesis of disease and, again, align a specific individual's cancer with the ideal treatment. The challenge is, how do we extend beyond this for those diseases in which genomics does not play as much of a role? And you can imagine that includes everything from heart disease to neurodegenerative disease and Alzheimer's, liver disease, GI illnesses, lung diseases, essentially everything else outside of the oncology space in which genomics doesn't allow us to understand disease processes in the same way in which it does for oncology. And in those spaces now, being able to use these small molecule biomarkers, which are an alternative information source, is really proving to be extremely valuable. Now, the way we think about these small molecules is that they're certainly dynamic, and so they're changing relative to your genome. That's a static process. Outside of oncology, once again, your genome doesn't change for the most part. And given the physical chemical properties of these markers, they can be produced within the tissues, whether it be the normal tissue, the healthy tissue, the diseased tissue, the microenvironment, wherever it may be, and can be released from the cells into the blood. And so we can non-invasively measure these from a blood sample or a urine sample, and it provides tremendous amount of insight into what's actually happening within the diseased tissue bed, whether it be in one tissue or multiple tissues. And that's proven to be extremely valuable for understanding disease processes, identifying new targets, and ultimately determining ideal therapeutics.
Can you kind of take me through how you see this space developing and how it's ultimately going to make a positive impact on patients? Because obviously you mentioned earlier how long it takes and how much it costs to even get something through trials. So
yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the space as a whole is still very early, and that's why it's exciting to be here at this point. I think it's changing and evolving very, very quickly, and there's really much greater recognition now from large pharma, early biotech, investors, et cetera, as to the role of dynamic markers. Again, your genome is static for the most part. And so being able to measure dynamic processes and dynamic markers that reveal those biological processes, I think there's greater and greater recognition month over month. And so while this area is early, it's evolving and emerging very quickly. I strongly suspect that in the same way the scientific community spent the last decade and a half building very, very large genomic databases, similarly, we're going to see a resurgence within the small molecule metabolomics or mass spectrometry space to develop databases around these small molecule biomarkers. Now, with regards to translation, I think, again, there's a tremendous amount that's been learned from the genomics world as to how we can initially make discoveries, measuring things at scale, and then targeting them and translating them very rapidly. And certainly, I suspect that's going to be the case for these small molecule biomarkers. So to give you an idea, when you go to the doctor's office now, and they draw those two tubes of blood every year as part of your annual physical, they're measuring about a dozen or so markers, half of which are small molecule biomarkers, whether they be creatinine or triglycerides and cholesterol levels, glucose, et cetera. And there's thousands of these markers that are in blood, even though we're only capturing a small number of them traditionally. And so as this field advances, I suspect that within a relatively short period of time, within certainly the next decade, I would say, it'll no longer be the case that we measure just 12 things in a blood sample, but we may measure 1,200 things in a blood sample, each of which provides a little bit more insight around a disease process as an early diagnostic marker, a prognostic marker, or a drug implementation marker.
How is that ultimately going to help patients? Is it just speeding things up, or is it just being able to diagnose earlier, or combination of things?
Yeah, it's all of the above. So you can imagine this sort of spans the entire biomedicine spectrum, everything from early diagnostics. And so being able to identify individuals at risk for a disease much, much early on in the disease process, years before it becomes clinically apparent, all the way through once a disease is being diagnosed to understand prognosis for a disease, understanding subsetting of disease processes, and then ultimately, again, being able to align that single individual and their disease with the right therapeutic. And this is the key. As you can imagine, as I mentioned earlier, even for the best therapies now, people only respond, a fraction of people only respond to that therapy. And that has huge economic and ethical implications. As you can imagine, if someone has cancer or heart disease, giving them a drug when you don't know if they're going to be a responder is problematic. There's economic cost to the system and insurance companies, payer networks, to the government. And obviously, there's a huge amount of consequence to the actual patient, both in delaying an appropriate therapeutic, as well as also absorbing many of the potential safety concerns around a particular drug. Now, as we can better align an individual with their drug, we should be able to greatly improve efficacy rates for drugs, as well as improve safety profiles for drugs. And that's the basic idea behind this. And the concept, again, is not new. This has basically been the concept of personalization of medicine for many decades. It's now finally the point that we have the technologies that allow us to actually implement and execute on this at scale.
You mentioned that it's kind of exciting to be in something that's in its relative infancy. Is it a part of biotech that, or biopharma biotech, that has a lot of companies working in it? And if so, what are others doing? And is there also a lot of study in universities?
Yeah, it's a good question, Jim. The majority of work that's ongoing in this space is still occurring on an academic level. These technologies and mass spectrometry is still relatively young relative to genomic sequencing. And so these technologies are still mostly being used in academia, or when they are used in pharma, for very different purposes, for drug development, for chemistry, for analytical work. And now being able to leverage these for biomarkers is, again, as you mentioned, in its infancy. There are certainly organizations that are interested in being able to do this. As I mentioned earlier, there's a number of technical and software hurdles that have to be overcome in order to do this properly. And this is where, again, Sapient was born, and the reason for spinning out this organization was that we recognized we had developed some technologies that were of great interest to individuals. And if we could accelerate that process for others, we'd be very excited to do so. And so the way in which we operate is as a discovery service organization. We don't do drug development internally ourselves, but rather we work with biopharma organizations, foundations, governmental agencies like NIH, other individuals who are interested in accessing these technologies and accessing the data in which we can generate for them.
I think one of the biggest and hottest topics at the moment in the general public and in the general media is artificial intelligence. How does that play a role here? And is that something that can speed up drug development? And if so, are there any dangers associated with that?
Yeah, it's a good question. And again, another area that's very much in its infancy, but has enormous potential to be transformative over time. And there's various areas, again, AI, again, we think of this as a tool that I suspect it'll be implemented over time. Everything, again, from early diagnostics, you can imagine around imaging studies and having AI-based imaging readouts. From a diagnostic and laboratory testing perspective, again, rather than measuring one or two diagnostic markers, being able to measure thousands of these at a time, and then using AI to really determine an individual's risk profile across multiple disease states. AI is being leveraged, as you're well aware, for drug development and novel chemistry. The challenge with all of these is that for AI to really, truly be effective, there's two components. One is input data, and the other is computational power. The computational power and the computing power, particularly for the cloud-based computing, has really changed substantially over the last several years. And now we truly have computing power to do this well across large data sets. The challenge is that we don't have really high-quality data sets in which to do this for. Now, where this has proven to be very powerful is with the ChatGPT and other sort of areas in which there's a lot of data to feed these machine learning and AI-based algorithms. And in medicine, we're still putting together the ideal data sets in order to train AI. Now, internally here at Sapient, we've generated what's called our human biology database, which now spans over several hundred thousand human biosamples in which we've collected them from around the world, along with the clinical information, analyzed these using our mass spectrometry systems, and developed some of the world's largest chemical databases that may be leveraged for AI. But that's still early, and how this is exactly going to play out is still unknown. And so there was a really fascinating article that just came out in this issue of Nature last week, and with an editorial in Science by Derek Lowe, talking about the promises and potential pitfalls of AI-based drug discovery. And it's an area that holds enormous promise, but is still extremely, extremely early. And I think as our ability as a community continues to grow, in our ability to generate data, these AI-based modeling systems are only going to be leveraged more and more over time. But what that exactly looked like is not clear to me yet.
Going back to the infancy of this particular field, it is early stage, and we've seen in many other industries that cost is an issue until it gets fully developed. Is that the same case here?
It's less of an issue, to tell you the truth. When you think about costs around drug development and particularly clinical trials, the cost for doing analytical work, whether it be with mass spectrometry or sequencing or other technologies, is really quite minuscule. It's less than 1% of a cost of a clinical trial. So as a whole, these costs really haven't been limiting. I think as technologies get faster and as processes get better, cost drops with it. We've certainly seen that in the sequencing space over the last decade. But as a most part, I think we're probably now even at a price point where doing large scale studies, and when I say large scale, meaning 10,000 to 100,000 plus, is not prohibitive anymore by cost.
And I would assume that it's a portion of a budget that would lead to savings in other areas, because if you can speed things up or improve drug delivery, then there's a savings by having spent on that in the first place.
That's absolutely right, Jim. So if you're, and I can give you a very concrete example, if you're able to identify a biomarker of response, so a companion diagnostic for a particular therapeutic, enrolling patients specifically based upon that marker, meaning individuals who are likely to respond to your drug, allows you to greatly shrink the size of a clinical trial by 20x, as well as accelerate the time course around that clinical trial. And so the savings economically to the pharma agencies is massive, but also the savings to patients. Being able to develop these drugs faster has huge, huge benefits for society as a whole.
And also, I assume that it doesn't give false hope to people if you're putting them on a trial that isn't really going to be of use for them.
That's absolutely right. I mean, again, it's still shocking to me today that our best therapeutics only work in a fraction of individuals that receive them. And we have to do better as a medical society. And being able to now identify who's actually going to respond to which drug and using that information to optimize clinical care is critical, not only for the pharma organizations, but for the patients and the hospitals and all of us.
And in terms of the big picture, obviously, if you have somebody that has a specific cancer and you say, you know what, this is really probably not going to be of any benefit to you, is there also the potential to investigate why that is, or potential other treatments or combinations of treatments that might be helpful?
That's absolutely right. And so this goes back to target identification and validation. So as we sort of perform these types of studies with our pharma partners, we not only identify markers that may reveal who's going to respond to a drug, but we begin to understand biological insight into why someone may respond or why they may not respond. And in doing so, that identifies new targets for new drug development. And so this is where these tools can be quite facile across the entire spectrum, not only in targeting therapies, but also identifying the new targets now for which you can drug. And so this is sort of one of the major applications for these types of data assets that are being generated.
Fascinating area. Where do you see it leading, or how do you see it evolving over the next few years?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think, again, we're at such an early stage that it's really exciting to be on this ride. I personally suspect that this field is going to evolve very, very quickly, and for multiple reasons. There's really mutual incentive across all organizations, whether it be government and payer networks, whether it be pharma, whether it be, most importantly, the patients themselves, to develop drugs faster, more efficiently, cheaper, and bring them to patients in a much more effective manner. And so there's no one across the spectrum who's not incentivized to realize that dream. The challenge has always been, how do we actually go about doing it? And I think these emerging technologies now really, for the first time, allow us to do this in the same way genomics has in the oncology space. These technologies are going to be instrumental and critical in advancing medicine, drug development, drug implementation across large populations in the very, very near future. So my hope, once again, is that in the next decade, an individual would go to a doctor's office once a year, and instead of measuring 12 things in a blood sample, we're going to measure several hundred things in that blood sample. And we're going to know exactly the information imparted by each one of those measurements. We're going to be able to diagnose disease at a much earlier stage. We're going to be able to understand disease and drug targets, and then ultimately, again, align the best therapeutic for that specific individual. That's where we need to get to as a community and as a society. Over the last 50 to 60 years, the majority of gains that have happened in medicine and life expectancy has really come from an improvement in preventative care, being able to diagnose disease at an earlier and earlier stage. And if you can do that efficiently, you can treat disease. The problem is, for the vast majority of human diseases, we're not diagnosing these until they're a decade in, and these processes are already so mature and tissues have been injured. And at that point, intervening is very hard. We see this in oncology all the time. If you can intervene at an early stage, you can usually cure the cancer. It's whether when you diagnose it at a later stage that it becomes really complex and a much, much more challenging problem. And so this is the basis for really allowing individuals to live a much healthier life. And then when they develop disease, to really find the best drug once again for that individual. I don't think anyone would argue that if I'm sick, I would love to have the drug that's actually going to work for me specifically.
Is there anything else you wanted to talk about?
We're excited for this space. And as I mentioned, our sort of role in this process is really to serve as a discovery organization. So we have these high throughput, very specialized mass spectrometry instruments that allow us to analyze very large sample sets. We have very complex internal biocomputational support that allows us to analyze the emerging data and identify single biomarkers of disease or risk or health. And then ultimately, as I mentioned, we have very unique data assets internally here that allow us to mine and cross-validate discoveries. And all of these components together are really required to do this efficiently, to do it effectively, and to translate this rapidly towards patients. And so this is where we view ourselves as playing a critical role. Again, we view ourselves as a service organization that supports the biopharma industry, early biotech, and foundations that really want to bring about change, that want to develop drugs faster, cheaper, and more efficiently.
That's great. Thanks so much.
I appreciate it, Jim. And if anyone's interested in more information, certainly don't hesitate to reach out. Our contact information is on our website, which is www.sapient.bio. And we'd love to chat with any of your viewers who may be interested in discussing further.
And that's it for another week. The interview that I had planned to run this week, I'm now running next time because I'm doing an extra interview for that one. But on the bright side, it means that I already have one done and already edited, and it will be the last podcast in June. So thanks a lot for joining us, and I hope wherever in the world you are, you have a great week ahead. Take care, and join us next week for another Beyond Biotech.